a suspected chemical attack in Syria today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Syrian town is hit with what looks like a poison gas attack. The government denies it, but this journalist on the scene says he felt the effects.
I cannot breathe well, I cannot see well, and I have headache.
Plus, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, once one of the best-kept secrets in America.
In the early days, I would ask, Daddy, what do you do at work? And he would answer, that is a government secret.
And renewed violence in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
You're starting to see that violence pick up again, and it undermines the social fabric of Juarez itself.
That's all coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. We lead off with a story out of Syria the White House says cannot be ignored by the civilized world. A suspected chemical gas attack on the town of Khan Sheikhoun. That's in the rebel-held Syrian province of Idlib. The attack reportedly left dozens of people dead and many more choking in the streets. Hadi Abdallah is a Syrian journalist who rushed to the town after the attack.
Now I have side effect because inhaling toxic gases. I cannot breathe well, I cannot see well, and I have headache.
This apparent chemical attack is being blamed by observers on the Syrian government. But Fares Shehabi, a government supporter and member of the Syrian parliament, says that's nonsense.
We are used to these fabrications and fake news since 6 years now. We don't need to use chemical attack. Actually, we gave up our chemical arsenal 2 years or 3 years ago. We have enough destruction power to get rid of fire in any place we attack, and we don't need to use chemical weapons.
He's referring there to an agreement brokered by the U.S. and Russia that required Syria to get rid of its chemical weapons a few years ago. Elliot Higgins is the founder of the online investigative network Bellingcat. He's been sorting through the dozens of videos that citizens and activists have been posting, recording the aftermath of the attack.
We're seeing all age ranges, men and women, quite a lot of children actually affected in this attack. And we're seeing convulsion, we're seeing pinpoint pupils, we're seeing foaming at the mouth. It's really quite shocking footage we're seeing. So symptoms are much more similar to the symptoms we saw on August 21st, 2013 in Damascus when sarin was used. Now, that's not to say this is definitely sarin, but it's certainly not chlorine gas.
How do you know these videos are authentic?
For one thing, you know, we have over 40 videos now. We can also see in the background of these videos various landmarks we can use to identify the location. So we've confirmed where many of these videos were filmed. And a lot of these victims are very, very young children, even babies, and they're convulsing, you know, the foams at their mouth, they've got pinpoint pupils. That's not something you can fake.
And some of the victims are being hosed down. Is that one form of treatment? You can just get the chemicals off the body?
You know, just handling someone who is wearing clothes with even a small amount of sarin on it can be deadly. So hosing down these victims is really to protect the people looking after them as much as it is to protect the victims themselves.
Your videos have been sent from multiple hospitals, correct?
That's correct. The victims were actually taken to a number of hospitals because there'd been a lot of hospitals bombed recently in the area. So they had to be taken away. One doctor I spoke to was over 50 kilometers away from this site that was actually attacked, and he was still turning away patients because they were treating so many victims.
Unbelievable. So what is the Syrian army saying about the airstrikes?
As usual, they're saying that they struck a chemical weapons depot that the rebels just happened to have. But the actual impact crater is in the middle of a street. It's quite small. So it seems very unlikely. The nearest target was a bakery and some grain silos.
And the Russian military, they've also weighed in?
Yeah, they're saying there's actually no aircraft that they were flying in that area belonging to the Russians or the Syrians anyway. But we do have footage that was filmed just around the time the attack happened showing airstrikes occurring. So that seems to be completely untrue. But to be clear, it's claimed to be an airstrike, but so far we've not seen any really strong evidence that 100% it was an airstrike that caused this. It could be there was an artillery strike around the same time that people missed because they were, you know, being bombed at the same time.
That would suggest that ISIS would have some store of some cache of chemical weapons and that they were released by this airstrike?
Well, or one of the other armed groups on the ground. I mean, we do know that ISIS has been using chemical weapons in the past, but it seems their preferred chemical weapon has actually been mustard-based agents. So we've seen mortar shells that have been used by ISIS that have resulted in people coming up with terrible blisters, the typical signs of exposure for that.
What toll has all this watching hours and hours of gruesome video, what toll has it taken on you?
It's never the videos that you would expect to be traumatic that are traumatic, you know, the really actual kind of horrible stuff. It's the stuff when you see, you know, you might see a baby who's been affected by a, you know, be hit by shrapnel and they're wearing the same kind of nappy that your own child wears. Or you might see, I remember when I was doing the MH17 case, there was a small toy just in the corner of one of the photographs that was barely noticeable, but it was the same toy that my sister-in-law gave my daughter when she was born. And it's those kind of cues that are what affect you more than the kind of the actual, you know, the horror you're seeing in the images.
From this attack so far, what do you think is the video that's going to have the most impact possibly on policy?
The images of the dead and convulsing children are absolutely horrific, but you find people shy away from sharing those because they think it's too much. But, you know, we've seen over the past 4 years repeated chemical attacks, repeated condemnation from international bodies, and nothing changes. We've seen endless chlorine attacks. We've seen sarin attacks repeatedly. And, you know, as soon as it gets to the UN Security Council, Russia puts their hands up and vetoes any action. We've only seen that only a couple of weeks ago where Russia vetoed action against the Syrian government for chemical attacks that the UN said happened. And they'll do this time and time again. So we can't expect the UN Security Council to do anything at all about this.
Elliot Higgins, the founder of the online investigative network Bellingcat, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The rebellion against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad began 6 years ago in early 2011. It was just after the big revolutions of the Arab Spring in Tunisia and Egypt. President Obama was in the White House then, of course. He wrestled with just how deeply to get involved in the Syrian civil war for the rest of his time in office. Now it's the Trump administration facing a similar question. I talked about that today with Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma.
The United States didn't want to intervene in the Syrian civil war and change the balance of power, destroy the Syrian regime, or push Assad out. And that's a terrible dilemma for the United States. And here we are, President Sisi of Egypt has met President Trump in Washington, D.C., and has, in a sense, been embraced by Washington in a way he hasn't been previously. And President Trump says, we've made a terrible mistake in the past by supporting regime change. We shouldn't have done it. It created chaos, and radical Islamic groups spread across the Middle East. We're now going to revert to supporting strongmen. And that means supporting Assad. Just the other day, Tillerson, Secretary of State, said that the United States was no longer focused on trying to remove Assad, that our unique focus was on destroying the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And that means overlooking the excesses of the Assad regime to a certain degree.
When you said earlier that the U.S. has to make hard choices, hard because there is no policy, as you say, or hard choices about what the policy will be?
There's nothing that the U.S. can do that's going to solve the Syria question. We have a deep-seated civil war going on in Syria with great distrust. We've got Kurds in the north. We've got rebel groups. We have the Syrian government. Questions of should Islam rule or should there be secular rule? These are deep-seated national dilemmas, not unlike the dilemmas that the United States faced in its own civil war. And if a foreign power had intervened in the American Civil War to stop it, it's not clear that it would have made the situation better. And that's, in a sense, where the United States is in the Middle East. We have tried every different policy. We tried occupation in Iraq. We tried quick removal in Libya. We've tried aiding the Saudis in Yemen. We haven't had success in any one of these. And that's got people in Washington distrusting themselves. That's manifest with the Trump administration cutting the budget by 37% for the State Department. It no longer trusts the State Department. That belief that money is being squandered in our foreign policy, and increasingly focus on military might. Military might has not solved the problems in Afghanistan or Iraq, and it's not going to solve the problems in Syria either.
If the sarin gas narrative proves to be true, why is Assad doing this?
Well, Assad is doing this because his military is relatively weak and he needs to use air power. He thinks that he needs to end this war soon. And the faster he ends it, the better it is for everybody. That's what he believes. You know, generals tend to believe this way. They believe that you want to use overwhelming force. You want to destroy your enemy before they learn how to counter. It's why the United States used the atom bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, which were not military targets, but they were a demonstration effect that was meant to end the war. And they succeeded. And that's the lure for every world leader, is to have those weapons that can overwhelm the enemy and destroy them. And in a country like Syria, we're seeing these to be deployed.
When I think about the images that have piled up over the last 6 years, Eylan Kurdi, the Syrian boy washed up on the beach in Greece, the traumatized toddler in Syria covered in white soot, and now these pictures of dead Syrian children. Do you think that the cuts to the budget in the State Department and the way the Trump White House is viewing the situation means that these images are just going to be less consequential the more they pop up?
Yes. There's a fatigue that's setting in, and we're seeing it in spades in Africa, where southern Sudan, Yemen, Somalia, terrible starvation is beginning to spread. And the world is not mobilizing to try to do something about it. We're turning inward. There is a sense of isolationism, but there's also a sense that we've just got to be very powerful militarily in order to respond to national security questions. Building the wall, getting better coast guards is a solution that Europe is increasingly turned to and the United States is turning to. And the centers of world power and world wealth are increasingly backing away. And in 12 more years, we're going to have another billion people on this earth. The pressures are going to be tremendous. The international community is going to be challenged by these sorts of regime collapse problems of civil wars or drought, environmental catastrophes. We've tried a number of different policies, and it seems only to get worse with each new policy. Whether it's regime change or closing your eyes, there isn't a good answer for how to deal with an Iraq or Syria. There doesn't seem to be a good path to follow.
So if people see these pictures, read this news, and are feeling helpless today, what can they do?
In order to solve some of these human dilemmas that are beginning to stack up, it's quite clear that the international community is going to have to find a new way of cooperation. And it's very possible that a country like China or India, that some of the BRIC countries are going to step forward and begin to establish the possibility for cooperation in a way that will help overcome some of these problems, because these are big problems. It's beyond America's ability today to go and fix Iraq, fix Syria, fix Afghanistan, and now this big drought that's setting in on Eastern Africa. It will take the international community. Obviously, individuals have to step forward, but it's going to require some real diplomacy. That, I think, is where good leadership will have to lead us.
Joshua Landis heads the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Thank you for your time today, Joshua.
Pleasure.
A quick look ahead at a story we'll have later on The World. Venezuelan rockers La Vida Boheme found themselves playing to empty venues a while back.
People stopped going out at night. Like 90% of the people, you didn't see them at night. So it was very difficult to make a living out of anything that related to music.
And things were going from bad to worse in Venezuela. So La Vida Boheme left. Find out where they ended up. Stay tuned. I'm Marco Werman with The World. The city of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, was once a government secret. It was built in the middle of World War II. Growing up in the 1970s, reporter Julia Barton spent a lot of time there. It's where her dad grew up, where her grandfather lived, and where he worked on mysterious gadgets, like one they called a glove box. But Julia never really knew what brought the family there in the first place. So she went back recently to try to find out.
My dad's hometown wasn't open to the public. The family moved to Oak Ridge in 1948, and there were checkpoints along every road into the city. We're driving by one now.
Everybody had to have a badge. At least all the adults had to have badges to get in the gate to the city. I mean, it was basically a walled city.
That's my dad, David Barton. He was 4 when the family moved here, and at the time, he didn't know why the city was walled off or what my grandfather did. Neither did his older brother, my Uncle Charles. He's with us, too.
In the early days, I would ask, Daddy, Daddy, what do you do at work? And he would answer, that is a government secret.
This is the city where scientists enriched uranium for Little Boy, the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, Japan. My grandfather, Charles Barton Sr., arrived in 1948, not long before the city was declassified. But the nuclear science continued. I'm no scientist, and never quite understood what my grandfather did for 30 years as a nuclear chemist here. The grandfather I remember was retired, dressed for church in his gray tweed suit, holding a worn King James Bible. He died in 2009, at 97 years old. I've asked my dad and uncle to help me make sense of his life and work by taking me inside the once secret complex where he spent his career.
Julia?
Yes, that's me.
Ray Smith, how are you?
Nice to meet
Go
you.
Go right on in. Turn to your left.
Hi, how are
you? Ray Smith welcomes us to Y-12, which government officials sometimes call the Fort Knox of uranium. It's run by the Department of Energy. Every American nuclear warhead contains uranium from this site. Somewhere behind these gates was my grandfather's lab.
So that's a microwave.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that melts metal. All right.
Smith is a Tennessee native who worked in maintenance here for decades. It was his idea to open the Y-12 History Center. We enter a room filled with gadgets, old lathes, equipment for space missions, an antique laptop computer. My grandfather would have found many things to love here. And from the way Ray Smith is beaming at my relatives, it seems he would have loved my grandfather.
I remember him talking about the ANP project.
Right.
And I always thought it had something to do with the grocery store that we shopped at.
No. Nuclear propulsion.
I know.
Aircraft nuclear propulsion.
Yeah, I thought it
never did fly, by the way.
Well, yes, I know.
So that's one thing my grandfather did. He and his colleagues tried to build a nuclear reactor small enough to power an aircraft, which sounds insane to me, but the same idea later worked in nuclear submarines. Oak Ridge got its start in the early years of World War II. The government roped off a lot of land in this quiet valley in Tennessee, which many locals didn't like.
With my darling to the Tennessee walls.
My grandfather came from a church-going family in nearby Jellicoe, Tennessee. My dad can still remember hearing an uncle talk about the day the Oak Ridge area was closed off.
One morning he drove through it, and the next afternoon it was closed and stayed closed. So that, you know, and the people that lived here were just all these little communities and stuff. They were paid for their land, and they were told they had to move immediately.
The laboratories attracted experts from Ivy League universities and even from Europe. So when my granddad arrived in this modern, walled-off city, he stuck out. He was deeply religious. And you might have noticed that you can hear Tennessee in the way the Barton family speaks. Dad and Uncle Charles think that because my granddad was so culturally different from his colleagues, he was sidelined in his scientific work.
I think my father had a really good reputation as a scientist. And so they just had a hard time reconciling how anybody, you know, that was such a, you know, brilliant scientist could be, you know, could go to a fundamentalist Baptist church. And
also, you know, he was a dry.
A dry was someone who didn't drink. As Southern Baptists, my grandparents even worked on a successful campaign to ban the sale of alcohol, which my granddaddy's colleagues probably didn't like.
We are approaching the American Museum of Science and Energy, which used to be known as the Atomic Museum. And my grandparents would just leave me here for hours on end.
Across town from Y-12, the old Atomic Museum serves as a kind of shrine to the official history of Oak Ridge. The story told here is that locals were kicked off their land for a good reason. The reason was that nuclear weapons saved more lives than they took, because they helped end World War II. That's the positive way of looking at Oak Ridge.
and the significant role they had played in bringing the greatest war in the history of man to an end.
Still, thinking about all that death and destruction is painful. No wonder I had trouble making sense of all this as a kid. What I did understand when I was little was the joy that can come from the science itself. I head upstairs to the interactive exhibits I used to love. There's a big model atom with orbiting electrons. My dad says it's out of proportion.
If there was a nucleus that size, the electrons would be miles and miles away from us right now. They wouldn't be anywhere close.
My dad's a musician. I'm a journalist. We don't know much about atoms, but a young kid is staring at us like we're science gods. I feel the need to rush on through the displays. Hey, wait a minute!
Glove box.
A glove box, yeah, yeah.
It's the same kind of safety device my grandfather helped improve back in the 1950s. Instead of plutonium, there's a toy puzzle inside.
Okay, I'm going to try to use it. Take my picture.
I stick my hands inside the awkward gloves. They remind me of coming here as a little girl, and I had no idea what any of this meant. Oak Ridge opens a lot of questions. Was it right to drop the nuclear bomb that was partly made here? Did the government need to force people off their land and build a secret city? But while I tinker with the puzzle, a lot of these questions fall away. My grandfather's name isn't attached to any famous discoveries or disasters. Most science isn't about those things anyway. It's about showing up to discover new things every day and being curious, consistent, and skeptical, no matter what is raging around you. For The World, Julia Barton, Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Julia's story about her family and Oak Ridge is part of our series about human relationships in the atomic age. We've got more stories at PRI.org/nuclearfamily. I'm Marco Werman. Some say these are dark times for Britain.
This is a country that faces many challenges right now. We've got Brexit, growing inequality, degradation of the environment, but that is not what Britain is worried about this week.
Nope, it's something about their Cadbury cream eggs. That's got a lot of Brits riled up. That story, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Coming up in a moment, what came first, sanctuary, the word, or sanctuary, the concept? But first, in a real-life example of sanctuary in France, one place refugees settled in France is the northern port city of Calais, even if the big migrant camp there, known as the jungle, was shut down last year. Adeline Sear has more from Calais.
On a wide and deserted street near Calais seaport, a police van keeps a watchful eye at the entrance of the charity Secours Catholique. In the yard, there are two new portable shower stalls.
Mais ici, c'est le plus gros, c'est de faire leur donner une douche.
Volunteer Pierre Leleu says he shuttles migrant men to this facility so they can shower. Then the young men can get some refreshments and pick some clean clothes in the warehouse.
Mais surtout se reposer, se repose.
And moreover, they can get rest, he says. They moved around all night to try and make it into England, so they're tired. A shower will make them feel refreshed and help them regain some dignity. Today, the police seem to be tolerating this operation, but it wasn't the case earlier. Last month, when the Secours Catholique brought in portable showers, the mayor's office parked a large dumpster in front of the charity's yard to block it from bringing in any more. A court ordered the city to remove the dumpster, but the charity's director, Vincent de Coninck, says the police kept pressuring migrants after that.
Every day they were arresting people, sometimes a group or one man and not another. That's what you call random harassment.
Inside the charity's large warehouse, stocked with piles of neatly folded clothes, Zakaria Adoun is looking for a clean pair of pants. Adoun is from Chad. Like most migrants who came here from Eritrea and Ethiopia, his goal is to reach the United Kingdom. And he keeps trying. Every night, he says. He goes from one gas station to the other, hoping to sneak onto a UK-bound truck. He vows he won't quit until he can meet up with his brother in England. Adun is only 16 years old. He's one of many youths who turn up in Calais to do the same.
We
began seeing migrants returning to Calais in early January, and the number has been growing every day since.
According to their estimates, 400 to 500 migrants are hiding in plain sight in the city, while local authorities say there are only about 100 to 150 people. Now that the mayor's city ordinances restricting crowd gathering and food distributions have been thrown out, humanitarian organizations are relieved they can once again work without constraints. But there's no question people and the region's economy have been impacted by the migrants' presence. Michael Wailly is a café manager in Calais' old quarter. He says the presence of migrants chased away many British tourists, but it also brought a new clientele. We had a lot of journalists who came to see the camp, and lots of British volunteers too, he says. He feels the city should help charities manage food distribution rather than attempt to forbid it. Other residents see it differently, though. On the edge of town, Jean-François Gracien runs an equestrian center alongside the site of the former jungle. He points to the brand new wooden fences the French government helped repair on his property after the dismantling of the camp.
Tout a été démonté.
Everything was taken down, he says. Gracien explains that migrants walked across his fields every night to pick any wood that could help them cross the deep water ditches separating the fields. Then they'd get to the gas stations on the other side, where UK-bound trucks are parked.
Donc moi, je passais ici à cheval pour aller en promenade avec les clients. Je pouvais plus.
Gracien says he could no longer take customers horseback riding in the area because the crowds around his property would scare the riders and the horses too. He says he even got a rifle out one day and shot in the air in an attempt to disperse a large group of migrants that had turned up. That got him arrested.
Donc c'est des traumatismes difficiles.
Gracien says those 2 years next to the jungle camp were traumatizing for his family. He says they're barely recovering financially and psychologically. So while he thinks migrants should be helped, he's afraid that allowing charities to feed them may lead to chaos again.
Ça paraît anti-humanitaire, mais...
It seems anti-humanitarian to say this, he says. But if we start doing this again, I'm sure we'll have 10,000 migrants by summer. And then, what do we do? Frédéric Van Gansbeek has the same concerns. He's the head of the Calais Business Association. He's worried the government is not doing enough, especially when it comes to determining how many migrants actually are in Calais.
Once again, nobody knows how many there are and where they are, and this is exactly what happened 2 years ago. And all of a sudden, boom, we had 3, 4, 5, 6,000, and there were not enough border police to handle this.
On this cold night, a few charities bring their vans to a soccer stadium back road where a crowd of about 100 men and boys converges. Volunteers hand out hot halal food. They've run out of sleeping bags, but they're still giving out blankets and warm clothes.
I say I need shoes.
Yes.
Laurent Vernet is a volunteer. He says city ordinances or not, nothing will change the fact that Calais is a natural frontier with England and a magnet for people in exile.
To go to the UK, there's not that many passages, and Calais is one of the very few. So it's natural, people will regroup here. It's geography, you can't change that.
For the world, Adeline Cyr, Calais, France.
Here in the U.S., several cities and states have declared themselves a sanctuary for undocumented immigrants. In other words, they won't go out of their way to help the federal government enforce immigration law. That sparked a debate around the country, as we've reported here on The World many times. Right now, though, I want to focus on the history behind the very concept of sanctuary. The word comes from the Latin word for holy place, sanctuarius, and the custom of offering protection to fugitives in holy places goes back to the dawn of time. Anne Desland is a researcher in Mexico City who's written about this. So, Anne, who was the first or what was the first instance of sanctuary that we know of?
There's an apocryphal story that scholars like to refer to that we have no reason to know if it's true or not, but it concerns the followers of Cylon. Cylon was an aspiring ruler of Athens in ancient Greece. And in the 6th century BCE, his followers fled to the temple of Athena on the Acropolis and said that they were political fugitives.
Are there also references to sanctuary in the Bible?
There are. It is Joshua in particular that talks about God telling the Israelites to designate cities of refuge. They use that term, the cities of refuge, and so it appears in the ancient Hebrew record too.
Right, so cities of refuge but not sanctuary. So perhaps the concept of sanctuary is older than the word itself.
Yes, I think that would be a fair statement.
So sanctuary cities now in the United States were preceded by sanctuary churches when a lot of refugees were fleeing Central America during those wars in the 1980s. Has it always been really kind of focused around places of worship, the idea of sanctuary?
The way that we think about it today is very much premised on there being a separation of church and state, which of course wasn't always the case in the Western world, most definitely. And so anywhere that had a kind of moral authority that could be seen as kind of superseding the legal authority, that was a place where you could appeal for your right to sanctuary and also request that you be protected in some way for some particular reason.
Has it always been about people seeking asylum, as we say now, or fleeing persecution of some sort?
It has. It's interesting, I think, that initially the principle was quite tightly focused around people who had been defeated in war or people who were being pursued by the families of someone they had killed unintentionally. And so in both of those uses of sanctuary, the idea is that you didn't deserve to die, basically.
Now, sanctuary cities here in the States and their mayors would probably like to believe sanctuary is a legal principle that will hold fast and protect them. But, I mean, undocumented migrants are by definition in breach of the law. Many people ask, why should they be protected from the consequences of their actions?
Well, I think that certainly the argument of the sanctuary movement, the churches who started the movement in the 1980s, and which is very much what is behind what we know today as sanctuary cities, the argument there is that many people who were coming over the border at that time were escaping civil war and, you know, active threats of persecution and death. There's many reasons to seek asylum from this part of the world. You know, people are unfairly caught up in things like the drug war, in things like endemic poverty.
Yeah, understood, but they're still not right by the law here in the United States, a lot of people would say.
Well, certainly the argument of the sanctuary movement was that that is an unjust law and that in that case, the superseding principle of sanctuary should hold, which is that when there is an unjust law, it is appropriate and morally correct to ignore it.
Writer and researcher Anne Desland in Mexico City. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Marco.
Adios. That's how Norte, a newspaper in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, signed off on Sunday. After 27 years of publishing, Norte is calling it quits because the paper can no longer guarantee the safety of its reporters. Norte journalist Miroslava Breach was shot and killed last month, the third murdered journalist in Mexico in the past 30 days. Norte's owner and publisher, Oscar Cantu, said, "No company, no business is worth more than a person's life." Chris Lopez is a former editor at Norte and also at the El Paso Times. How surprised were you when you saw that headline, Adios, in the news about Norte, Chris?
I wasn't terribly surprised by Oscar's decision to close Norte following the assassination of Miroslava. I was obviously shocked by Miroslava's assassination earlier, but I wasn't that surprised that Oscar took the steps he took to close Norte and move on.
You work pretty closely with the owner of the paper, Oscar Cantu, and with Miroslava Breach. What do you remember about how she worked and why she took these risks as a journalist?
She was fearless. I was fortunate to work with many very good journalists over 30-plus years, and Miroslava was at the top of the list in her drive for facts and her drive for truth. And really, she was a Mexican at heart, and Mexican journalists want something better for their country, and they want something better for the people who live there every day, particularly in Ciudad Juarez and throughout the state of Chihuahua. And that's what her passion was. Her passion was to hold power accountable, as all journalists strive to do. And she was particularly attuned to cartels and how they were eroding society in Ciudad Juarez and in the state of Chihuahua. And she was very admirable in how she went about her work day after day, knowing the dangers of her reporting lines, knowing that she was even putting her life in jeopardy. And what's even more tragic is she had a very lovely family. And her son, I recall so many days in the North End newsroom where her son was at her side because she brought him into work because she was a single mother and she wanted to take care of her son. That was as important to her as her journalism. And he admired his mother. And that, frankly, is what's very sad about her death. It's sad about Norte as well. And they were a newspaper and a newsroom as a whole that believed in the mission of holding power accountable. And in Mexico, that includes the cartel leaders, includes what's happening there in the feuds for territories in Ciudad Juarez. And so it's a very sad time.
What's going to fill the void? I mean, is there another newspaper in the area that people read?
So Juarez was fortunate to have two competing daily newspapers, Diario de Juarez and Norte. So they were competitors, but they were also colleagues with each other. And frankly, journalists in Juarez look after each other. Diario will continue to do a good job there in reporting on the events of Juarez. Norte was a counter to some of that Diario reporting in terms of how Norte saw things. So it was a very competitive market in that regard.
There were 10 journalists who were murdered in Mexico last year, and my understanding is not a single person has been held accountable. Who do you hold accountable for this violence?
I hold the cartels, the feuding cartels in the state of Chihuahua and in Ciudad Juarez. I think there is also at times collusion that goes on between government and cartel leaders. So I don't think anyone's hands are clean when it comes to the violence against journalists in Mexico.
What are you hearing from other Mexican journalists, like the closure of Norte? Is it going to send a signal to other newspapers, to other reporters?
Certainly. And if you go back a few years, this isn't the first situation where a journalist was killed and the newspaper, had some setbacks as a result of that. What I think about are the dozens of journalists in that newsroom of Norte and what they're going to do now with their lives, because they were committed to journalism and they had been there for many, many years. And it was a very good professional staff. And, you know, someone like myself who worked in a variety of newsrooms in America and then was able to spend some time in a daily newsroom in Juarez, I was able to gauge what I thought was the level of professionalism and the level of ethics in a Mexican newsroom versus an American newsroom. And I saw a lot of commonality between the missions, between the visions of journalists. So for me, I think about the people that are left behind and now have to figure out what they're going to do to make a living. They're not pursuing their own lines of journalism that they love to do. So I think about those people now and I wonder how they're going to come about. I've certainly reached out to a few of them and I wish them all the best.
Chris Lopez, a former editor of Norte and also of the El Paso Times. Thank you for your time today.
Okay, take care.
Over the years, you've probably heard of the War on Christmas, the debate over whether Christians are being discouraged from openly celebrating the religion during the holiday season. Well, in Britain, another war has broken out. Call this the War on Easter. And it's all about chocolate eggs and rabbits and probably peeps, too. Leo, do you know what a peep is?
I don't know what a peep is.
That's our London reporter, Leo Horneck. So what's going on there with this war on Easter?
Well, Marco, this is a country that faces many challenges right now. We've got Brexit, growing inequality, degradation of the environment. But that is not what Britain is worried about this week. It's all about what to call a chocolate egg hunt for kids around the Easter holiday. In an eggshell, for hundreds of years, I think for 100 years, in fact, there's been a tradition of having chocolate egg hunts around historic buildings in Britain, you know, for kids, very lovely tradition. And it's usually been organized by Cadbury's, the chocolate maker. And they have usually been called an Easter egg trail. I mean, that seems fairly simple.
Parallel with our Easter egg hunts here, which are
right.
Real it's, eggs, hard boiled or chocolate.
Right. And you know what the kids prefer. But anyway, this year, it was retitled the Cadbury's Great British Egg Hunt. Do you spot a word that is missing there?
Yeah. So what was the origin of changing the name? Why did that happen?
Well, it's not clear exactly where this change emerged, but the reaction was, let's say, volcanic. Let me give you just a flavour. The Archbishop of York, one of the most senior figures in the Church of England, his response was, "To drop Easter from Cadbury's Easter egg hunt, in my book, is tantamount to spitting on the grave of Cadbury." The Prime Minister got involved today. She was asked about it. She said that it is absolutely ridiculous to drop the word Easter from an Easter egg hunt. Then there's the backlash, Marco. One of Cadbury's descendants, her name is Esther McConnell. She is a great-great-great-great-granddaughter of the founder of the Cadbury's firm, John Cadbury. She said, in fact, he wouldn't have minded because he was a Quaker and the Quaker tradition is not to emphasize festivals, but to regard every day as holy.
You know, I thought initially this was a story about all people in Britain wanting to kind of celebrate this. And why do we need to call it Easter? It sounds more like this is a story about Cadbury trying to sell more eggs.
It may be that there was something to do with that in the motivation originally. Cadbury's came back with a pretty fair point, really, which is that actually the word Easter is in a lot of their promotional material. They just changed the title of this egg race or egg hunt.
So I started by talking about the war on Christmas. Is that actually a debate that is happening in Britain?
There is an anxiety about just how multicultural maybe or multi-religious this country is becoming because more and more people do not identify themselves as practicing Christians. And that reflects the changing nature of Britain, just as it reflects as well the changing nature of the US. So the reason that some people get so exercised and so get their eggs in such a...
I'm reaching.
The reason that some people have decided to make such an omelette of this is that it does touch on really big debates about what it means to be British and what kind of society we live in.
Yeah, for sure. Our man in London at the BBC, Leo Hornack. Thank you so much, Leo.
Thanks, Marco.
The headlines out of Venezuela today are all about the political power struggle there and the clashes between security forces and anti-government protesters. But behind those headlines, other serious problems go unnoticed. Petty crime is unreported. More violent crimes like murder and kidnapping have become commonplace. Venezuela is now one of the most dangerous countries on earth. But the thing is, it's been getting worse and worse for a while. Just ask the members of the band La Vida Boheme, who left Venezuela a few years back.
Our booking agent in Venezuela had just been kidnapped and murdered, you know. Our manager back then had been kidnapped also, like, few months after, you know, something like, it just seemed like to be very close to us, the fire.
That's Henry Dartanay. He's La Vida Boheme's bandleader. Guitarist Daniel De Souza agrees with him. If they had stayed in Venezuela, it would have been impossible to still be a band.
People stopped going out at night, like 90% of the people, you didn't see them at night. So it was very difficult to make a living out of anything that related to music.
This all took place about 4 years ago. Hugo Chavez had died and Nicolas Maduro had just been elected the new president. Violence had already been spiraling out of control, and things were getting worse as the country entered a recession. Here's Henry Dartanay again.
When you're in a situation like that, you either can stay and endure the economic, the violence, the stress, and even I think the hopelessness of seeing that things are not changing. Things escalate. It's not like something that has been steady wrong. It's been like getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse.
In 2014, La Vida Boheme took off for Mexico City. They left friends and family behind in Caracas. And even though there's violence in some parts of Mexico City too, Daniel De Souza says it was a place to recharge and regroup.
It was like a way to escape from where we were living in and to another place that it wasn't that different from where we live, in a kind of way that we speak the same language and the culture is very similar in some way. So living in Mexico for us has been like less difficult than another place, I think.
La Lucha, The Struggle, is La Vida Boheme's latest album. They recorded it in Mexico City. It dropped last week. ¿Qué estoy haciendo aquí? Pagando para vivir. Escogiendo sin opción, perdido donde nací, escaparme de mí, en Caribe o París, una lejana canción, sigue llamándome, sigue llamándome. La Vida Boheme has built a whole new fan base in Mexico. It's just like starting over, says De Souza, but it's been worth it.
The mountains are mountains. It's something I believe that Mexico is a perfect city like for rock and roll bands now because there are so many young people from everywhere.
And here's one more track from La Vida Boheme's La Lucha. This is Vosé. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Dame de baja. Los narcos alinean como astros en empresas y partidos. Código azul, ¿qué hacer? Atrapado cual minero en San José. Años malos, años buenos. Sin guardia ni sin centeno. Cul-de-sac, no hay salida. ¿Es verdad o es verdad que es mentira?
PRI, Public Radio International.